It's time to awaken to your ultimate potential.
Always something to learn.
The more real and truthful you can get with yourself, the happier you're going to be.
Nothing happens in the comfort zone.
There are no set rules on how to attain success and to feel fulfilled.
Each one of us are born with a purpose.
For me, I knew there was something bigger.
You don't conquer the mountain, you conquer yourself.
I'm Crystal Bauer, wellness expert and entrepreneur. Each week, I'm speaking with incredible individuals, inspiring you to awaken your ultimate potential. Welcome to the Live Greatly podcast.
Sometimes it feels good to just make yourself not so important, make everything about your context not so important, and be humbled a little bit and relieved of the stress that it's all on your shoulders and everything's so important. And that's how I feel when I'm traveling.
I'm so excited about today's guest. We have Matt Higgins here today. You may have seen Matt as a guest shark on ABC's Shark Tank. I love that show. He's doing so many incredible things, and he's really had to overcome a lot of different challenges throughout his childhood and throughout his life, and he's really paved his way for great success. He's going to be sharing his insights into dealing with imposter syndrome. If you've ever been in that situation where you felt like you didn't just quite belong, you're going to gain a ton of value from today's episode. Matt is the co-founder and CEO of private investment firm RSC Ventures. He's a well-known entrepreneur. He's also an executive fellow at Harvard Business School. He's co-owner of VaynerMedia, founded by Gary Vaynerchuk. He's really doing so many different things and has a ton of value to offer in today's show. We're going to be talking about how to have your inner dialogue support you. And you're also going to find out what Damon John said to Matt on Shark Tank that helped boost his confidence. So let's jump right into it and welcome Matt to the show.
Thanks for having me. Love talking about wellness. I need more of it.
Right? Don't we all? You know, I learned a lot about you through watching your Shark Tank episode, and they had that whole intro about your story and your backstory. And I was doing a little bit of research before our conversation, and I was really blown away by your story. And I'm hoping that you can share a little bit about how your upbringing has impacted you and helped get you where you are today, because you had challenges that you had to overcome and you are, you know, so extremely successful. So I would love to know a little bit more about how your childhood has impacted you now as an adult.
Yeah. Well, we could start there. It's the honest answer is good and bad. I mean, everybody brings some baggage with them. And I always believe, I know it's a cliche, but every crisis does create opportunities. And for me, it definitely opened up an aperture to a parallel universe. But to go back in time, under extreme poverty, I had a mom who struggled with disabilities her entire life. She's incredibly smart, but grew up, she was a high school dropout, doing basically cleaning homes for elderly senior citizens. And around 38 years old, she got divorced and decided to go get her GED and go to college. And so my upbringing was sort of watching this very strong, you know, single mom raising four rotten boys, try to figure out how to climb her way out of poverty, while at the same time progressively succumbing to just a whole bunch of different ailments and having no health care, having no help. So there was a lot of good and bad lessons. Some of them are very raw and real. There's no cavalry coming. You know, it's just the fact that there are no happy endings guaranteed and you have to write your own. But at the same time, you know, the die is never cast. I mean, so probably when I was around seventh grade and I was watching things get progressively worse, I was maybe 13 years old. I was working at McDonald's, scraping gum from underneath the table. And I had an epiphany very young that why don't I do on purpose what my mother did by accident, which is go get my GED as soon as humanly possible, because there was a loophole back then, which has since been closed, that if you took your GED and did well enough, you can go to college right away. And I would scan the penny saver back then, the little free flyers that people would hand out. And I would notice college student, $8 or $9. And I was making $3.75 at McDonald's. And I was thinking, if I drop out of high school, get to college right away, I could make $9. I mean, that was the simple epiphany. And then I had to balance that with, that's like a pretty big price to pay to get out of here quickly. And I learned a bunch of things too. When you live a life of shame, no one really knows what you're going through. And so the advice you get from people is not contextualized. So the advice that I would get from adults was, that's crazy, you're going to throw your life away. Meanwhile, I was doing everything I could to conceal what was going on at home, including wearing guest jeans and just trying to look like I had money because I was embarrassed. Mm-hmm. And so that was the most important decision I made in my life, because it taught me that it's okay to go out on the bleeding edge and to do what's right for your circumstances and don't just accept conventional wisdom. I dropped out of high school at 16, took the GED, my SATs, enrolled in Queens College when I was 16. And by the time I went to my prom, you know, I was president of the Bay team. And so, and I remember seeing my teachers there like, okay, you know, it went from that look of pity to a look of respect. And so I always tell that story, one, because I like that story. And I want people to connect with me on that story, not because I'm on Shark Tank, because it matters to me that people feel that they can climb out of their circumstances, right? And I don't want to be, it's funny when you arrive at a certain place in life and you leave your past behind, which you don't really, because we're all a product of our upbringing.
Yeah.
You have to almost work to bring it forward. But I care so much more. I'm much more interested in me from where I came than from where I went, if that makes sense. So I just like to share it with everybody.
Yeah, that's a wonderful story. Thank you for sharing that. And something you said resonated with me, and I want to dig a little deeper. And I can't remember your exact words, but it was like, you never really leave that behind or where you come from. And I'm curious, like, if you've dealt with kind of this imposter syndrome, being where you're at and having that upbringing. And I know, like, for me personally, it's interesting. It's my journey the past year is kind of surreal. And I was sitting back yesterday and I was talking with my husband about this actually. And he was like, wow, this just happened. I'm going to have my first like live TV appearance, like all this stuff. And I'm sitting there and I'm like, it doesn't quite feel real for me. And I'm still kind of like, huh, it's interesting, because I felt like when that stuff happened that I had wanted for so long, there was going to be this like big moment. I don't know. And I'm still like, I still feel like the same person. So it's just interesting. So I'm curious for you, because you've had such a dramatic shift, if that's ever the case for you, if it doesn't quite feel real to you, you know?
Well, yeah, I mean, a couple of points. Number one, yes, imposter syndrome. It's actually one of the great disappointments of life, because you'd think you'd arrive, you'd cross some certain threshold of the universe, and then you'd leave it behind. And you would feel that I am here because I belong here, right? That's something I always say to myself. That's the only validation the universe needs. And the reality is that's the only validation the universe will ever give you. No one is ever going to tell you you've been credentialized.
Yes.
Welcome. You know, you belong. And unfortunately, it's up to you to deal with that, which is why I talk a lot about how you have to train the voice in your head to be your mm-hmm. greatest ally rather than your enemy. Because you realize a lot of that imposter syndrome is completely self-generated. Yeah. No one's, fortunately, I mean, you're maybe picking up signals, which are true. Somebody's judging you or, you know, wishing you poorly, but mostly it's self-inflicted. So the answer is yes, I have to deal with it all the time. The second part of your point, you know, do I feel like, oh, I've made it, I've arrived, like never. And I've given up trying to achieve that. What I've shifted instead is to define what I need more narrowly, the more successful I've become. Actually, which I realized I think is the secret to happiness. I'm never going to feel like the next thing is the thing that finally I pulled it off, whether it was going on Shark Tank and now I
yeah.
teach Harvard Business School. It doesn't do it. It doesn't fill that sort of void of striving. But what does do it is to realize, what do I really need to feel like this was a life well-lived? It's like, I need my children and I need to do right by them first and foremost. I have my partner, who's amazing, and my best friend. You know, I have a roof over my head. I have autonomy. That's kind of what I need. And then the rest is gravy. And then you're free to just strive. Because I find joy in life is in the striving. And, you know, I think that applies to a lot of people, most people, whatever striving is for you, which is why you experience melancholy when you finish the marathon, you know, and you've trained for 4 months yeah. and you finish Shark Tank. And I remember the feeling I had after Shark Tank. Like, that was among the most stressful things I've done.
Really?
And now I'm sad because I can't conceptualize what might be harder than this, right? And then next thing you know, a year later, I'm teaching at Harvard Business School. I was like, this is definitely stressful. So I have stopped seeking that sense of arrival and decided to work on feeling like I arrived already while maintaining this intense desire to strive and fight and, you know, and just be defined. Because I don't want to lose my edge either, because that's also really boring. Like, right? I don't want to feel content, watch Netflix on the couch all day either.
No. But, you know, some of the things you're saying, I've been thinking about recently, and there's this neuroscientist, Dr. Huberman, and he talks about this, people who are really high achievers, and how, you know, you have these huge goals for yourself, but if you're waiting for the goal to be for your satisfaction, you're not going to be happy. So it's finding that joy in the journey, which it sounds like you're doing. And along the way, what happens is you're getting this dopamine release. And, you know, dopamine is like that feel good chemical you get when you get a like on your post, or, you know, when you are kind of working towards that goal, or when you hit that goal. But then the other thing you're talking about, as far as the satisfaction you have with your family and with your relationships, you know, that's more of that gratitude, which is like a serotonin type neurotransmitter, which is so important. So I think when people are prone to entrepreneurs, particularly if you're like setting these high goals and you don't spend enough time getting that serotonin going, it's going to be a rocky ride. You're going to have like highs and lows, and it can be really hard to feel fulfilled. But it sounds like you've got it down, because you're
no, I've got the language down.
This is
just understand, like, I consume endless amounts of information about diet, meditation, brain chemistry, the amygdala, everything.
Yes.
It doesn't mean I implement it. I always want to like a disclaimer on every one of my posts. Please be advised, this is purely aspirational. I'm saying it right now because there's an underlying hypocrisy, because I'm trying like you are, right? So I don't want to pretend that I think I have a lot of the answers. I think the consolation prize of trauma is pattern recognition and a pretty good understanding of things, because you're so hyper aroused when you're, you know, going through stress. And I went through a lot of stress as a kid, up until I was 26 and my mom died. That being said, so I think I theoretically have a lot of the answers, but every day is a work in progress. Talking about it is cathartic, because I think it makes a gift of our experiences. That's probably the number one thing that gets to me, is like just wanting to make sure I manifest truthfully about that it's an ongoing struggle. I think a lot of times social, even in now that we're, you know, we fetishize vulnerability, right? And so now we all know vulnerability is what's expected of us, and to project it. But even the vulnerability is packaged in a nice arc. I went through something bad. I hid the bad thing. I overcame the bad thing. I am now better. And look at my life. And then anybody else watching is like, oh, mine didn't move along that progression. I find myself regressing. And that's why I really feel like it's important to talk about the regressions, you know what I mean? As opposed to a finished product. Cause I think that's very alienating to people, because it's not how most of us relate to the world. I'm regressing constantly, making two steps back, one step forward in every area of my life. So to answer your question, I think I have a good sense of what, you know, what it takes. I still pursue dopamine. I think that I love the way you just put it. I think there's two ways to deal with an amygdala that's flashing like a cantaloupe. One is dopamine, one serotonin. Mm-hmm. And, you know, dopamine is just papering over the problem, and serotonin is resetting yourself. And a large way to get there is through, you know, meditative practice.
Yes.
Another thing I aspire to do that I don't do often enough.
I relate, you know, so I've been meditating every day. And when I say every day, it doesn't mean it's like a great meditation. It might just be like a couple minutes, but I've been doing it every day for the past like 4.5 years, you know, since mom's cancer diagnosis, really. Like right before that, actually, it was interesting, is when I started to get more interested in that mind-body connection. And I just, in the beginning, before I started working again, I had a lot more time and I would have longer meditation practices. And what's tricky for me now is like, I know the benefits of it, and I know it really helps me, because my brain's very busy. I'm doing a lot of things. I'm like, I've got a lot of goals. I'm juggling a lot of things. So it helps me calm that down. But now that my business is kind of taking off, it's actually harder for me, which is frustrating. Like you said, you know, because I talk about this all the time. I've been trained in it, but like you said, it doesn't make it any easier when you're a real person, a human being going through, you know, the ups and downs of life. But I found now, if I meditate like with a meditative walk, or like incorporating some movement, that is helpful for me right now, because I just have so much going on that like sitting for an extended period is hard.
No, I find that the greatest gift that I can give myself that I deny myself is meditation. Because you're right, as you become more frenetic and you got more things going on, the cost of doing it is high. It is a high cost. I mean, I think it's something that we should talk about. Anybody who's highly intentional with their time, they're like, what's 20 minutes a day? I'm like, 20 minutes? Like, and this is not somebody who watches TV. You know, I never watch TV unless I'm with my wife watching a movie. So the idea that I'm going to give 20 minutes, yet when I do it, it's the greatest gift. Like I emerge from 20 minutes of meditation, suddenly the colors are vivid. The consequences are de minimis. I'm like, whatever, who cares? But it is so hard to do it. It's still hard for me. I go in periods of commitment and then I go back. So then I read all the studies about what it does to your brain chemistry to try to reinforce it. Like Oh, if I do this, I'll change the shape of my brain over, you know, 20 days. For once, I wanted to do like an MRI study so I could actually measure it. So I could get a feedback loop. You know, no, I didn't do it. But this is how obsessive I would get about creating the feedback loop to remind me that it's really doing something. But some of the most peaceful, I find when I come across somebody who seems very self-possessed and calm and they give you that great feeling and they know where their ship is headed and why it's headed in that direction. Oftentimes they say, oh, I practice TM, something like that. But even if you don't meditate, being present, like you said, locked into the moment is a good start. But it's the one thing I wish I could stick to every single day.
So one thing that I've been talking a lot about, and probably because, like I mentioned, juggling a lot of things, so is setting a goal of just 2 minutes a day. And that's something that I think works well for people who are so busy. And so you don't have to start with setting aside 20 minutes in the morning. It could be like before you have a big meeting or, you know, whatever it is, if you're doing something that maybe is a little bit more intense, take 2 minutes and just focus on your breath. And then that, you know, over time, it can build, but I think just those small like micro breaks for our nervous system can have a really like positive impact in the long run. And that's one thing I want to kind of lead into is the issue that I see a lot with professionals and entrepreneurs with burnout. And in the healthcare, you know, profession as well, I'm not practicing clinically anymore, but a lot of, you know, with COVID and everything else, burnout is a huge problem for a lot of people. And I'm wondering with what you do, I mean, because you've invested in a lot of different companies, and what have you seen, or have you seen anything that's been successful as far as preventing burnout in business owners, entrepreneurs, you know, people that you've worked with or in yourself?
No, that's a great question. I don't have any magic answer, but generally philosophically, I think it begins by adopting the idea that if you don't establish boundaries for yourself as a leader, then no one else will, right? That it's natural for employees, especially somebody rising up or ambitious, to want to mimic your behavior. So if you pride yourself in like, I work all day and night and I haven't taken a vacation in 4 years, those little things are signals to people that that's what you approve and what you value. So you can't say, do as I say, not as I do. So if you're living your life that way and you're skipping important moments in your children's lives, it's very hard for people who work for you to do that. So that's number one. Accept that as a fact, no matter who you are. Number two, employees who don't have boundaries around their personal lives will burn out and become very unhappy and ineffective over time, because that means they have no space to be human. It means when they come to the office, they have to shut off their personal life because the signals have been told that you can't be human here. You know, so I just think it's very important to begin there. Understand that when you take those licenses, as you might define them, right? Like I'm taking something for myself. Recognize that actually what you're doing is setting the bar for everybody around you. I, for example, see my kids every single Wednesday for the last, I don't even know how many years, you know, I'm divorced, right? But custody schedule is really important to me and making sure I maintain an ongoing presence. And I would do anything humanly possible to ensure that I would stick with that. Fly across the world from China and back to make sure I'm there on a Wednesday. Like, hey, that was just down the block in China, you know, but also important as it is to me and to them, I think it's important to people around me, because as a leader, they would say, well, if he's doing that, that means it's okay for me to do that. Wow. And then when I would find people, you know, doing the same for themselves, it just makes everybody happier. So that's the number one way is to set boundaries. And if you don't think you need any, I am terrible with sleep. I try the best I can. I do work really hard. I work day and night. I enjoy it. But at the same time, my boundary is my family and my boundary is my children. And I'm highly intentional with dinners or anything like that, because I don't want to deprive my family of that time or me. That's my boundary. And everybody knows it doesn't matter what the boundary is. The boundary just needs to be personally important to you, and you need to set it publicly to give permission to other people to do the same. So that's why I think this notion of an objective standard of work-life balance is kind of nonsense. There's no objective standard. Your balance could be like mine. Like, I love getting up and hitting it at 6 a.m. because I know that I can play offense since nobody's awake. You know, I mean, I love that time period at 5 or 6 because it means I can focus my energy outbound as opposed to responding to everybody.
Yeah.
So I'd argue, well, you're not balanced because you're going from 6 to 8, whatever. For me, that's balanced because, you know what, every Wednesday, there's time with my kids and every, you know, and I don't do dinners with anybody unless I really have to, because it's time for my wife. So that's my balance. Not a long philosophical way of saying setting boundaries is really important for you as a leader so others can do the same in their own life.
I want to take a moment to talk about Cardinus Risk Management. They are a leading health, safety, and risk management specialist offering online and on-site solutions for all areas of your business. And I was so excited to partner with them in creating a well-being course so that companies can give their employees the tools to have healthier, happier lives. I covered stress management, movement, nutrition, work environment, how to navigate flexible work environments, remote work, and working in the office, and so much more. So if you are looking for support for your team members or your employees or for yourself, please reach out to Cardinus and they can help you access more information about this well-being course. There's going to be a link in the episode details.
Do you do anything for stress relief? Like, do you work out? Do you have any, like, do you listen to music?
That's a good question. I work out pretty consistently. I'm the worst yo-yo dieter, even at my age. I'm ashamed and embarrassed to say that, but like, my weight goes up. My body just really wants to be heavy. So I'm constantly fighting that battle, unfortunately. But I do work out and exercise. And I love travel. Mm-hmm. Probably the happiest I am is when I am free to roam planet Earth. Love airports, believe it or not, looking up at that board and say, where am I going next? You know, it's sort of, fortunately, my wife meets me all over. Like, we have done the craziest trips you could possibly imagine. I had to be in China.
What's the craziest trip?
What'd you say?
What's the craziest trip you guys have done?
I mean, well, she just loves to see the world too. And we're, you know, bonded over that. And it's like roaming around with your best friend. But I had to be in Australia and China for soccer matches we were putting on. Fun. And like, I always think everything is like the outer boroughs in Manhattan at the center. It's like, it's all just like Queens, Bronx, Brooklyn, Bronx. It doesn't really matter. So we flew to Australia to go see this match in Melbourne, the cricket ground. I was there for 36 hours and then we flew to Shanghai, which was like, it's just right up down the road. You know, 13 hours later, went to Shanghai. We had a soccer match there in Shanghai and wow. Then came home. So it was like a 7-day trip. But what's nice is if I were to die tomorrow, I went to Sydney, Australia, and I went to Shanghai. And I think sometimes we sort of like to sequence our experiences. I think I do a pretty good job of bringing everything concurrent and not assuming that I've been promised tomorrow, because I haven't been. I've only been promised the next minute with you or even next second. So I'm pretty good at identifying what I really care about. Hanging out with my best friend, traveling, seeing places, being with my kids. The rest is kind of gravy. So we've been in like amazing places. Like, I had to be in Slovenia for work meetings, and I forgot I hadn't told anybody that she was going to come meet me. And we're in a restaurant, and one of my coworkers was like, is that Sarah? And I was like, yeah. Well, we had some miles, so she flew to Munich on miles and then flew overnight to get to hang out and fly back. And she was so excited because she did it for like $400, you know? Like, yeah. I happened to marry a DIY queen who can do everything. It's incredibly crafty. So I don't know. That's my balance and that's my joy. It really is travel.
Yeah, travel. I grew up traveling a lot. We would do road trips and I love it too. And the thing about travel too, kind of from this like mental health perspective, is when you're in these new environments, at least for me, I'm present. Like, I am there. I'm taking in everything. Everything's new. So it's such a wonderful experience for mindfulness too. And that just brings that whole new level of like exhilaration and joy. When you can share that with those that you love, I don't think it gets better than that. So,
no, and I love being confronted with the fact that there is no norm per se. I mean, there's normative values that are important to you and how you treat people and treat yourself. But in terms of how to do a thing, that they're, you know, what you think is how it's done is not how it's done all over the world. And I love, and one of the downsides of being in the United States is self-contained universe, right? Where even when you're in Europe and you put on the news, you get a BBC, you're learning about every neighboring country, right? And you're learning about Africa. Here, you're exposed to crime on the news I'm talking about, right? So I do think it's amazing when you step outside of our culture and you expose yourself all over the world. You're like, oh, there's so many different ways to get it done. And we should be respectful and understanding of culture and of mm-hmm. otherness. And like, there's not one uniform view. And I love that. I would love going to China. I went to China 4 times over the course of the year. And I love that I didn't speak the language. And it's just sort of, you're almost like floating. Like, I can't read the signs. I don't know where I am. I'm supposed to be in Nanjing. Not sure where that is. Gonna have to catch the equivalent of an Uber and figure it out. And that's so life affirming to be almost humbled. That's how I feel when I go to the mountains too, and I look at them and be like, these have been around a long time. Mm-hmm. Like, they're looking down on me right now, like I am a speck in the scheme of things. And sometimes it feels good to just make yourself not so important, make everything about your context not so important, and be humbled a little bit and relieved of the stress that it's all on your shoulders and everything's so important. And that's how I feel when I'm traveling.
Yeah, I love that. Actually, this morning I did like a quick little meditation, and I like to, sometimes I'll do like a guided visualization with it. So I'll picture myself someplace I've been, or, you know, someplace I want to go. So this morning I was on a mountain. So I was like up there, and just automatically I felt so peaceful. So I haven't done that in a while, but it was just, I think just even taking yourself there, if you can't physically get to that location right now, you can go there in your mind, even if it's for a couple minutes, and that can really just, it can work wonders just for boosting your mood.
Yeah. That's awesome.
Yeah. You know, I would love to talk a little bit about mindset. And you had mentioned earlier that being on Shark Tank was stressful. And I figured that. I mean, it's intense. And even watching it sometimes, I'm like, oh my gosh, ah. it can get pretty aggressive in there sometimes. And I'm curious what feedback or tips or suggestions you have for people who are in environments where maybe it's with their boss, or maybe they are pitching, maybe they're pitching on Shark Tank, whatever it is. And they're around people who are exuding power and intensity, and how to, how they can stay grounded and confident. And kind of earlier too, you were talking about that inner chatter, that voice that isn't always so nice. How can they quiet that inner voice and crank up that empowerment voice in those situations?
Yeah, great question. And one, I hope if you take away nothing from this conversation, is like, no matter who you think and how successful they are about where they've arrived, they probably are dealing with imposter syndrome, or, you know, they're just covering it up somehow. Because anybody who's doing hard things is probably because they're doing something new. And new things, by definition, make you feel like, to a degree, an imposter, because you are, right? You're pushing your way in, whatever it means to, you know, whoever is the accepted group of people that are doing whatever that is. In this case, sharks, right? So by definition, it's uncomfortable. It's hard. You're going to feel like you don't belong. And the way I did it was a piece of advice that Damon had given me, from those who watch the show. We're both from Queens. And I have a great picture of us in the dressing room, and he's just talking to me. And he was like, don't let anybody tell you that you don't belong here. Like, you belong here because you are here. And that was the conversation. Something I would sort of say to myself, like, no one's going to validate whether or not you should be in that room. So it's really incumbent upon you. That's number one. Mm-hmm. Number two, just realize, ask yourself, how many times in life has somebody externally really put you down and said that you shouldn't be in that room, versus how many times have you told yourself that? I mean, unless you're living in a conflict-filled environment, most of the time it's really that voice in your head. And it's like, where does that come from? Like, it's incredibly so destructive. I talked about this in a commencement speech I'd given at college, about how it's just so important to grab that voice by the scruff and be like, stop it. Yeah. You know what I mean? I need you on my side. And I always say to saying, if not you, then who? If you're not going to love yourself, then who's going to love you? And it's a job that you cannot delegate or outsource. You cannot expect anybody else to love you unconditionally or to fill that void. It's really incumbent upon you. It's a topic we don't talk enough about. It's one, the voice in our heads, and two, give practical tips about how to train it to be your ally. And I always begin saying, it's the fundamental, most important obligation you have in the universe, is to love yourself first and foremost, and one that you can never delegate. And I think a lot of people go wrong throughout their lives looking for, if only I could receive this kind of love, I would be fulfilled, or I would be validated. Yeah. And that's where so much yearning comes from in this life, so much sadness. And if you can make that little switch and be like, I don't know, if not me, then who? You know, why would I expect somebody else to know my worth if I don't even know my own? And you just need to accept that this is your mission, your obligation. And it kind of begins from there. I know that's very cerebral and psychological, not very practical, but it is where it begins, is understanding your universal God-given obligation to love and respect yourself first and foremost before you expect anybody else to do the same.
Yeah, I totally relate to that. And I like to say a lot, like, don't believe all of your thoughts. A lot of your thoughts are lying to you. They're not real. So I think once you have that awareness of, it's that simple, like, don't believe all your thoughts. And then once you recognize that, then you can create space between your thoughts and who you are, recognize that your thoughts are not who you are, and then you can choose again. And that's really helped me on my path. So, you know, if somebody has a thought, like I mentioned this to you before we were recording, that I was afraid of public speaking, but I thought I was really bad at it. It's because I got so nervous with it. I would get the butterflies, and, you know, I never did it. So that's totally expected, right? You're doing something in front of a bunch of people that you don't do that often. But I thought that meant I was bad at it. And as soon as I created space around that thought, and I shifted it a little bit to, like, well, maybe I'm not bad at it. Maybe it just makes me uncomfortable. And right. So I tested it and I did it. And I was like, no, I actually really love it because I'm talking about things I'm bringing value. So I think for people out there, you know, just don't believe those thoughts and you can choose a different perspective. You know, there's always a higher perspective that is more loving and empowering for you.
Yeah. And I do think a lot of it stems from a lot of the things that make us feel uncomfortable or an imposter stem from us not wanting to be quote unquote seen, right? Because we feel like we're either concealing some type of shame or vulnerability. So mm-hmm. I find that if you do a lot of self-work around vulnerability and shame and realize there is no shame in this world, right? We're here for a limited period of time and we're all human. If you sort of unburden yourself and if you are forgiving with yourself, you accept that, you'll find that you actually start not to feel that way when you walk in the room, because you start to feel like you have a right to be seen as you are, not as you're expected to be, or not as you believe you should be. Once you start saying like, I have a right to be here as I am, everything kind of fades away. It's how I spent so many years living in this dirty little apartment, taking care of, you know, a sick parent and being embarrassed for anybody to see it. I mean, it's a lot of years, 26 years, not having anybody come over. Like you just have this compartmentalized universe. And I think that's one of my big regrets is well, I mean, how as a kid are you able to really understand that? But looking back in time, what that does to you in terms of feeling like you need to have shame or conceal whatever you quote unquote is wrong with you. Mm-hmm. I think if you come to really work on that, I'm not saying this is the case for everybody, but I do believe a lot of the anxiety around imposter syndrome is what will happen if I'm seen for what I believe I think I am or what is wrong with me. I'm not a good public speaker. What if I stutter? What if I mess up? Or like, I'm uncomfortable here or this, that, and the other thing. Once you give yourself the right to be vulnerable and to have idiosyncrasies or blemishes, the imposter syndrome does start to fade away. Unfortunately, it does seem to take until you're about your 40s to figure all this out. I'm sorry, all you folks in the 20s or 30s. But I can tell you something else. So anybody out there who's in their 20s, just know that there's nothing you break in your 20s that you can't fix in your 30s. So it's going to take you a little time to realize everything I'm talking about, but that's okay because you have plenty of time to fix it.
I didn't have my big shift. My shift didn't start until my 30s. Yeah. I mean, well, like I would have had my kids a little earlier, but like my big, big shift, you know, was a little bit later on. Right. One more thing I want to touch on, if you're comfortable talking about it. I know you had a cancer diagnosis mm-hmm. a while back, and I'm curious how that has impacted just your views on life, because I'm sure that that had to have a substantial impact on what, you know, how you're living. And I would just, we'd love to hear a little bit more about that.
Yep. I had a testicular cancer survivor. I don't like using the word survivors. I feel like it tempts fate, but I got over it. Let's just put that. And I got it when I was 32 years old. I had just had my first child, who was only 3 months old at the time.
Oh,
my career was, you know, meteoric. And I had just been in charge of the business operations of the New York Jets. So I was riding high and, you know, overachiever, whatnot. And then I had a pain that I wanted to ignore. And my ex-wife actually was like, you have to go do something about it. And what's crazy is like your life is moving along this trajectory. You're entirely vested. I finally felt like I was winning. You know, I'd been on this urgent race to sort of get somewhere. Remember, by 32, my mother had only passed away when I was 26. And I was press secretary, the mayor of New York and doing all this crazy stuff. And I finally felt like stable and huge job. And then I get this pain. And within 36 hours of getting it looked at, I was under the knife. And you're like, wow. And a lot of your identity, you know, this is not like a minor surgery, right? You're sort of processing that. Very quick. They want to remove the tumor very quickly. And I remember in between that moment of the surgery for several days later, they thought it was much more advanced. And, you know, there's a lot of different trajectories. Testicular cancer can be very treatable, you know, if early, but if it metastasizes and spreads, it's a whole different story. So what I most remember from that time is from surgery to when I found out it was stage one and I needed a radiation. In between that, everything I think about on a daily basis, oh, I can't wait to try to buy a brownstone in Brooklyn one day, or all these material things are all status, didn't hold up against the juxtaposition against immediate death, right? That I might be dying. And I'm not sure if I said that, you know, perfectly well, but my point being, a lot of the things we think about every day don't matter when you think about that you may die any day. And yet we act like we may not die any day, right? So my takeaway was I didn't die then, fortunately. I recovered, had to take a radiation, went through a lot of stuff. But the fact is, our mortality is ever present. And actually, a lot of during that period when I was going to Sloan Kettering and was dealing with cancer, I felt very much in touch with the meaning of life and the universe and, mm-hmm. and very peaceful and grateful for some very simple things. My beautiful little baby, everything, like the things that mattered, mattered, and the things that didn't receded. And so I'm actually spending a lot of time always meditating on that moment to try to capture it without being so grim. Like, how do you be ever present of your own mortality, and rather than have it be a sort of Damocles hanging over your head, actually be something to grab onto that unleashes your full potential. So I have an app on my phone called We Croak. It reminds me several times a day that you may die one day. And it has incredibly inspiring words. And the logic is, I forgot where it comes from, Bhutan, where they do talk about death openly. It actually makes you say, calms you say, oh, right, our time here is limited. Mm. Let me make the most of it. And that's not something to be afraid of. So I guess the answer is the biggest way it changed my relationship with death and made me much more peaceful and realize this is not something to be afraid of, but something to understand and process as part of the journey.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for sharing.
Well, my kids think it's completely crazy. Like, phone goes off. Like, this is
what is that, Dad? You know, you're taking it as like you wanted to help you live your life to the fullest.
Yep.
You know, so it's, you know, things like that do, they wake you up. And like with my mom's cancer diagnosis, it woke me up. And that's when I was like, I'm going to live my life to the fullest, because like you said, obviously I wasn't the one experiencing it, but I was going to her appointments and it was a shock. And it had that impact on me of like, I don't want to look back on my life and say I didn't do something because I was afraid to fail, or because I was afraid someone was going to judge me or whatever. Because like, who cares? Right. In the big picture, who cares? Like, yes. I totally, totally get it.
And isn't that all we crave? I mean, most of us crave a lot, like to be relieved of the sort of weightiness, you know, and sort of excited to be peaceful about whatnot. That's why I was sort of fascinated. Now, fortunately, granted, if it had been more serious, terminal, clearly I would have had a different perspective. But I do think being sideswiped, I want to hold on to the lessons of it, which is very hard to do in the heart's charging pace of the universe. Very hard to go back in time and be like, remember how you felt? But I do think it changed the trajectory, like a little booster rocket that got the ship going in a slightly different direction. I do think it gave me a glimpse into something that I wouldn't have seen if I hadn't had cancer. And I have to say, I'm kind of grateful for the experience. I'd be lying if I said it was necessarily a bad thing that happened to me. It's not true. I mean, it sounds obviously great and I'm a cancer survivor. The reality is I am net, net grateful for what I went through, even though I still deal with the lingering effects of it today.
You know, well, it woke up, like you said, it woke something up in you to help mm-hmm. you live your life in a different way and hopefully have a really fulfilling life. And you're doing amazing things.
Well, thank you. So are you, by the way, going ahead and sharing yourself to the world and trying to get people motivated to take care of themselves. You gotta get me focused on healthy eating and eating plant-based more. I'm trying.
Yeah, we'll talk. We can talk off air too. That's one of my favorite things to talk about. I just gave a lecture to a local university about the gut-brain connection and the anti-inflammatory diet. And I love nutrition, but you have been phenomenal. I don't want to keep you too long. So how can people like find out more about you? What are you up to? Is there any place people can go to learn more?
I spend a lot of time on LinkedIn. LinkedIn is my preferred platform. It's the realm of positivity and thoughtfulness. And so I just enjoy it. Anybody out there who hasn't really embraced LinkedIn as a content platform should really think about it. If you have a business or an idea that you're trying to get traction, I think LinkedIn is the closest to a meritocracy there is out there, thanks to the algorithm. So you don't need a huge following. Don't be ashamed or worried about putting anything out, because a post could end up having 100,000 views. So just make a gift of yourself and communicate. So I'm almost spending exclusively my time on LinkedIn. Matt Higgins, say hello. Tell me that you heard about us here.
Matt, that's actually when I was, I'm on LinkedIn a lot and I was seeing your stuff. I was like, I like his sense of optimism. And that's when I was like, I want to have him on my show, because I really was enjoying your content. Because you do, you put out stuff, it's uplifting.
So I feel like we're heavy today. Were we heavy? This is optimistic. No.
It's not heavy. I mean, I think today we're just being real, you know, yeah. Having a real conversation.
Bringing it down. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. This has been great. Well, thank you so much. I really, really enjoyed it.
Thank you for having me. Take care, everybody.
Yeah. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks, Matt. That was
great. You're welcome. Good. Thank you.
It was wonderful spending time with you today. Just one quick ask. This information is incredibly important to more than just you. So think of just one person today that you can share this episode with, and together we can spread this message that you don't have to sacrifice your well-being to attain success to others who need it. Valuable episodes like this one are published weekly so you and others can have the benefit of reaching your ultimate potential. So click the share button, get this episode into the hands of just one person you know who would gain great value from it. I will see you next week.